into your day-to-day tattva. Inconceivable oneness and difference between Krishna and Krishna's energies. Rather than going right into the verse, I think I'm going to just give a little background. Each of the different Vadas are doctrines. Dvaitavad, Vishishta Dvaitavad, Shuddha Dvaitavad, Dvaitavad, and Achinta Veda Veda Tattva, the teaching of Lord Chaitanya. Each of them has a different perspective on the relationship between the Absolute Truth, God, the source of everything, and everything that comes from that source. Some have the emphasis that they're totally distinct. Some have the emphasis, like the Shishta Advaita, that there are the Shishtas or attributes, this is Sri Vaishnavism, that inhere within the Supreme. And from time to time, those which inhere within the Supreme manifest. Sometimes not manifest, but there's an inseparable emphasis as on the identical relationship between all things with God. And Lord Chaitanya's teaching is, for the message of the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita references that are being made, it's simultaneously, but Madhvacharya's emphasis is, they're distinct. Dvaita. There's, in fact, his theme throughout his writings and teachings. There's Panchaveda. There's God and the living entities, and they're distinct. There's God and material nature, and they're distinct. There's living entities and material nature, they're distinct. There's living entities, and they're distinct. And nature, and nature, and they're distinct. Distinct. Great to love. Two. So, some Vaishnavas emphasize the distinction. Some Vaishnavas speak about the inherent inseparable nature between God and His energies, and Lord Chaitanya says, His teaching is, achintya, that's inconceivably, there is Dvaita and Advaita, or Veda and Abheda. It's like the mind is a binary processor and it's simultaneously one and a zero. Well, binary processors can't encompass simultaneously one, it's one or the other. But that's why the inconceivable. You can certainly contemplate the inconceivable, something that's simultaneously one and a zero. But you can't hold it within your mind. Simultaneously one and zero. So it's, in that sense, it's inconceivable. One with and different from at the same time. So that's the subject. And there are three, I'm going to take three different channels. One is the verse itself, another is another verse from the Bhagavatam, another is the early verses of chapter 9 of Bhagavad Gita. And three spokes, all approaching the same jewel at the center. I'm doing this backwards. Instead of reading the verse and explaining it, and then we're going to read the verse. But it will help you understand how Prabhupada writes, what he does. There's one of the Chatur Shloki verses of the Bhagavatam, chapter Stoki means the four essential verses that, the nutshell that express the whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam in four verses. So if you can get at those four verses and unpack the meaning that's there, you've got the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. The first of them starts Aham Evasam Evagre. It's second canto, chapter 9, text 31. Aham Evasam Evagre. The verse is saying, Lord Vishnu is explaining to Brahma, Lord Narayan is explaining to Brahma. Krishna is explaining to Brahma. At the beginning of creation, I alone exist. During the period of cosmic manifestation, I alone exist. And after cosmic annihilation, guess what? I alone exist. That's emphasis on the oneness feature, the Advaita, the non-difference between God and His energies. So if we take it without the Advaita part, then it means the microphone is God, the book stand is God, my finger is God, because there's an Advaita relationship between all things and their source of emanation. And if you really bore down in that message, you might very well wrongly come to a conclusion of impersonalism, where everything's God. Because there's an absolute relationship between all emanations and the source. Prabhupada describes in the purport the problem that impersonalists have, even with that notion, which sounds like an impersonal notion, is that thinking of the source as one thinks of a material entity, a material object, a thing, like the classic example is you take a piece of paper, rip it into small pieces, you're holding the pieces in the palm of your hand, you distribute the pieces, and now the original piece of paper is distributed everywhere. But the original piece of paper is gone because it just got distributed. So if you think of God as the source of all things, then that which He distributes becomes God, and He just, kind of lost a job. He went out of existence. He's homeless. He doesn't exist, because now He's just all over the place. So the solution is, everything comes back to a position of oneness, and then we can breathe easy again, we're God again. Now we're disintegrated gods, and then we just become integrated gods, and that's the solution to the problem. Something like that. The first verse of the invocation of Isha Upanishad says otherwise. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnam Udachyate Purnasya Purnam Adaya Purnam Eva Vasishyate. It's not just for alliteration purposes that Purnam is repeated many times. It's the Purnam means complete. And the complete is so complete, the absolute complete, is so complete that although so many Purnams emanate from the Purnam, that source of emanation, the Purnam, is still Purnam. And that's inconceivable. Can you conceive of something so big How big is that something? It's so big, you take away something, it's still unchanged. And take away a whole bunch of something, and it's still unchanged. You take away everything that exists, and it's still unchanged. That's big. That's the absolute truth. It's not within the realm of material experience. Because no matter how big something is, take away a little something. Take away a grain of sand from the Sahara Desert and it's less. Theoretically, you could vacate the Sahara Desert, just take away all the grains of sand and what's left. It's not the Sahara Desert anymore. So, this is the conception of the Absolute. The subject is the Absolute, the source of emanations, and the emanations. So, the Bhagavatam would like us to understand, or say it this way, Vyasadeva's doctrine, his Vada, is called Shakti Parinama Vada. Parinama means transformation. Everything that exists is but a transformation of the energies of God. That's what Purusha Sukta confirmed, this chapter 6 is explaining. The energetic and is expanded energies, and then those energies transform, and then those energies are withdrawn. And the supreme, the supreme is complete with the unmanifested state of those energies and the manifested state of those energies and then again the unmanifested state of those energies. There is this oneness relationship between the energetic and the energies, but the energetic is the energetic and the energies are the energies. That is to say, the energies don't create everything. The energies are created by that which creates everything, the energetic. So there's a distinction, but there's a oneness. So one has to be careful, like, you know, have a big picture. When you read something that speaks about the difference and you read something that speaks about the oneness, if you have a big picture, you don't just go, yeah, 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 or yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. That's one feature of the Absolute, and there's another feature of the Absolute. And they're both absolute. The big picture is there's simultaneous oneness and difference. That's based upon this. The subject is the relationship of God and His energies, or more specifically, the inconceivable simultaneous difference and non-difference between the Supreme and His energies. So that's one of the approaches. This Chaturshloki verse, Aham Evasam Eva Agre. So if you hear that phrase sometime down the path of your spiritual progress, Aham Evasam Eva Agre, sometimes our acharyas just refer to the verse by that phrase, and that's what the whole subject is about. The inseparableness of everything that exists with its source of emanation. So then, next we'll go to the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and then we'll go to this verse for this morning. The ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita is called the Most Confidential Knowledge. Guhyam. It's confidential, or Krishna is declaring it, so it's not that confidential, but it's confidential in a different sense. It's confidential in that it's difficult to understand. Hear ye, hear ye. And then it's still confidential because it's difficult to understand. And Krishna says, this is the introductory verses. It's the most confidential knowledge. I'm going to disclose to you, da-da-da-da, Arjuna, something that you can understand and others commentators that come along generations later, they're not going to understand it. And he states the qualification that Arjuna has for understanding it, that he's his devotee and his friend, and therefore he can understand it. Arjuna's not particularly noted as a great jnani and scholar. He's a devotee. He's Krishna's friend, so he can understand it. Now, Prabhupada quotes in the purport of this morning's verse the following 9-4 Bhagavad Gita. So the first three verses of the ninth chapter are the Mahima section. This is so great, this is wonderful, and most confidential, most secret of all secrets. It gives direct perception of the self by realization. And the third verse says, those who are not faithful, they're not going to understand it. They're caught up very tightly by the material energy and covered, and with that covered state, they can't understand it. Then, first, this most confidential knowledge starts with Maya Atitami Dham Sarvam Jagat Avyaktamurtina Matstani Sarva Bhutani Natchaham Teshu Agastata. So, in the purport, Prabhupada goes to the Avyaktamurti, the unmanifested form. Murti means form. Avyakta, Vyakta, Avyakta. Unmanifest, manifest. So Krishna is saying, by me, Maya, by me, Tatam Idam Sarvam Jagat Avyakta Murtina. By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. Matstani, all beings are in me. Stani, Matstani, Sarvabhutani. And then the sleight of hand, Natchaham. I'm not. All beings are in me, and at the same time, I'm not in them. We're in the room, we're not in the room. All beings are in me, but I'm not in them. So, to understand what he's saying, one needs to understand the relationship of God and his energies. That, so, he expands his energies from the unmanifest to the manifest agent. There it is. And all beings are resting in that inseparable energy of Krishna. That's the inseparable part. But then he has a separate. He's the energetic. He's not one of the energies. He's the energetic. And he has his abode. He has his spiritual realm. And in that spiritual realm, he has his loving associates, all the spiritual forms, spiritual activities, spiritual qualities, spiritual names. No touch of matter. That's him. But the energy is also him. In that it's from him. And all beings rest in his energy, this Avyaktamurti. I'll just read the translations of these four verses, 9, 4, 5, 6, and 7. This is Krishna explaining, or at least laying it out, the Chintaveda Veda Tattva philosophy. By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And yet, everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Not chakra. Manstani Bhutani. Although I'm the maintainer of all living entities, and although I'm everywhere, I am not part of this cosmic manifestation. Myself is the very source of creation. He's explaining to Arjuna the relationship that he has with everything that's created. And he uses this metaphor. Understand, it starts, yata, like this, tata, so that. Tata, tata. So, like, understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all beings rest in me. Because the sky is more subtle, as the wind is blowing within the sky is not moving around. The sky is unchanged. Wind is changing, moving here, moving there, different velocities, different intensities, and that's all happening within the sky, the more subtle energy. So in this way, understand all beings are resting in me. So Krishna's form is all spiritual, and he manifests the material ingredients and the combinations of material elements is arranged by him, and it's all happening. And it's all resting in him. But he has his separate existence. Deep subject matter. Very wonderful purports. Now, this morning's verse. Esha adhya purusha kalpe kalpe srijatya jaha. Atmani atmanatmanam sa samyachati paticha. So here's, there's three things. Srijati, that's creation. Samyachati, that's withdrawing, absorbing, and then pati is maintenance. So creation, maintenance, and dissolution. Three phases of existence. He is saying Atma, Atmani, Atmanam. Atmana. It's resting upon him. That this is the inseparableness. Back to the Chaturshloki verse. So here, Brahma is explaining that he, the Purusha, this Sa'esha Adhya Purusha, the original Purusha, Mahavishnu is that original Purusha. He's an avatar. Avatar means one who descends. So that means from the Vaikuntha region, an expansion of the Supreme Lord. Sankarshan comes, not different, but it's an expansion for with a function, the function of creation. So the first Purusha is Mahavishnu, and Srijati, he manifests. Pati, he maintains. Samyachati, he absorbs. So he expands the universes, maintains universes, withdraws them again within his transcendental body. So there is this inseparable, because the expansions of those energies don't happen without the source of emanation, Mahavishnu. The maintenance of those energies does not continue without Mahavishnu. The withdrawal of those energies back within himself doesn't happen without Mahavishnu. So there's this inseparable Atma, Atmani, Atmana. It's from the Supreme. At the same time, he has his own separate existence. That's also stated. He is unborn. Sa'esha Adhya purusha. There's things that are born, but he's unborn. There's things that are changing, and he's unchanging. Things that are resting in him. Back to Bhagavad Gita. But he has his own abode. In the purport of the Bhagavad Gita, verse 12, I give this really simple example. He says there's an industrialist, that's maybe not here, it's in his lectures. There's an industrialist and he's on the golf course playing golf. And the industrialist has a big factory with hundreds of workers. Nothing happens in the factory without the industrialist saying this should happen in the factory. He's just off playing golf. And hopefully he has his cell phone off. So they can't even contact him to say, you know, but it's on the strength of his energy. And that's just a material example. But as we have those experiences within this world, so what to speak of God? It's not just he's on the golf course. The very energy itself comes from him. The movements of that energy are under his direction because an expansion of himself as Paramatma within every atom is overseeing and sanctioning whatever the material energy does. And yet he who is the source even of this, the Purusha avatars, as Purusha Sukta says, he exists in the three-quarter portion. That is, in the spiritual world where there is no matter, there's no modes of nature, there's no time, there's no karma. And it all happens because he exists. Like your question yesterday, well, is there a reason for his existence? Because he exists, all this stuff exists. And the living entities, they also coexist. And some living entities have, I want to be independent from you kinds of desires. And so the material world is created so they can have some place where they can try to be God, although it's not possible, but they have their great aspirations, great expectations. And the whole show is set up by the Supreme. So I'll read now some of the language and it hopefully will. Some of the subtleties of what Prabhupada is saying will jump out and you'll appreciate how beautifully he's described this. The translation of text 39 reads, that supreme original personality and God of Lord Sri Krishna expanding his plenary portion as Mahavishnu, the first incarnation, creates this manifested cosmos. But he is unborn. The creation, however, takes place in him, and the material substance and manifestations are all himself. He maintains them for some time and absorbs them into himself again. The oneness is being emphasized. Purport. The creation is not different from the Lord, and still he is not in the creation. This is explained in 9.4 Bhagavad Gita. We read it. Mayatatamidam sarvam. The impersonal conception of the Absolute Truth is also a form of the Lord, called Avyaktamurti. Murti means form, but because his impersonal feature is inexplicable to our limited senses, he is the Avyaktamurti, form. And in that inexplicable form of the Lord, the whole creation is resting. Or in other words, the whole creation is the Lord himself, and the creation is also none different from him, but simultaneously, as the original personality of Godhead Sri Krishna, he is aloof from the created manifestation. Now here's, he goes a little deeper, and here's the apparent existential dilemma that Freudian personalists, they can't comprehend. This simultaneous oneness and difference. Explains it very wonderfully. The impersonalist gives stress to the impersonal form or feature of the Lord and does not believe in the original personality of the Lord. But the Vaishnavas accept the original form of the Lord, of whom the impersonal form is merely one of the features. But that's the perceptual or conceptual distinction between an impersonalist and a devotee, in a nutshell. The impersonal and personal conceptions of the Lord are existing simultaneously, and this fact is described clearly both in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and also in other Vedic scriptures. Inconceivable to human intelligence, the idea must simply be accepted on the authority of scriptures, and it can only be practically realized by the progress of devotional service unto the Lord, and never by mental speculation or inductive logic. The impersonalists depend, more or less, on inductive logic, and therefore they always remain in darkness about the original personality of Godhead. Their conception of Krishna is not clear, although everything is clearly mentioned in all the Vedic scriptures. A poor fund of knowledge cannot comprehend the existence of an original personal form of the Lord when he is expanded in everything. And the concluding sentence of that paragraph: this imperfectness is due more or less to the material conception that a substance distributed widely in parts can no longer exist in the original form. It's a one or a zero. And for binary processors, it's either or. And we see this, and so that means that isn't. Unless we say, this isn't. There's some that do that. Jagat Mithya. The world is false. Brahman, Satya. I'm almost done. Then we'll have our discussion. Prabhupada writes, the last paragraph just stands on its own. The conclusion is that these, that's, you know, the creation, maintenance, dissolution, resting for some time, creation, the cycle of the cosmic manifestation, unmanifest, manifest, for some time withdrawn, the whole, these are but displays of the Lord's inconceivable personal energies, of which no one can have full information. This point we have already discussed. So while there is this system, and we can to some degree kind of get an idea of the system, how the whole thing is working, we can't know it fully. There's one place in the teachings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur where he's teaching village people Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. And, you know, it's a sophisticated conception, and he explains it really simply in the question answer. Well, you said this, and what about that? He gives the answer. Okay, but what about that? And he gives an answer. So it goes along to a certain point, and the question says, well, this sounds pretty conceivable. Why do you call it inconceivable? And the answer that Bhaktivinoda Thakur offers is, when you speak of this in steps, you can present it conceptually, But when things are actually happening, to have full realization of how it is as it's actually happening, it becomes very mysterious. In other words, so we can sit here in the living room, the temple room, and talk about this stuff, and then when we go to the office or start doing things in real life, where did that conception go? It's just, you know, out the window. And here we are stressed out over stuff. Keeping the conception of the personality of God is very clear. It's difficult when dealing with his complex energies. But how it's working, and at least we can get something of a glimmer of an idea through the disclosure that comes through the verses and purports of Scripture. There's more things, but that's the essential idea. So Brahma's sharing this with his son Narada. It's kind of a recapitulation of the whole chapter. You wanted to know how this whole thing happens. Here's how it happens. And now it's the summary. Mahavishnu manifests, maintains, and withdraws everything. Although the original person from whom the Purusha avatars are expansions, the original person remains unchanged through all the changes of creation.
When you talk about impersonalists,
Who are you speaking? Persons, impersonalists are those who hold as a conviction, like, you know, a principle of how it is, that there is no spiritual form of a supreme being. Then they have, there are different versions of what there is, but they hold there isn't a spiritual form of a original being. Such a notion is fallacious. That's an impersonalist. Some would say what there is an undifferentiated spiritual existence called Brahman. Some would say nothing exists. Some would say matter alone exists. And they have different constructs of doctrine that say that. Those are different categories of impersonalists. And there's, you know, subdivisions and further divisions. But a fundamental theme is spiritual form does not exist. Original spiritual form from which everything has come does not exist.
So would a Buddhist be, yeah?
Yes. They're voidist, which is a form of impersonalist. They don't say, shunyavad is the Sanskrit term. Shunya means zero. Vada means doctrine, the doctrine that everything ultimately is void. And the aspiration of a Buddhist, in the highest sense, is to enter into a state of nirvana, where you have entered into that state of nothingness, with the understanding that now we're just going along with an illusion that in fact doesn't exist. And what does the illusion rest upon? Nothing. That's the doctrine. And then there's another variety that says all of that rests upon Brahman. Brahman is spirit. All-pervasive spirit. Take away all the veneer, and what's underneath the veneer? Brahman. And we are that Brahman. now we're identifying ourselves falsely with something that we're not. So all you have to do is shut down the program of identifying what you're not, and then you're possible to realize that you're Brahman. But such persons who say, ultimately everything is Brahman, if you present to them the idea, well, Brahman is but a feature of the Absolute, which ultimately has spiritual form, they'll say, no, 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 no. Because then you have variety, and in the Supreme there's no variety. You can't have form. It's just homogenized oneness. Brahman. That's their argument. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, in chapter 14, the last verse of the chapter, I am the basis, I am the pratishtha of Brahman. Which is like saying, the rays of the sun are supported by, or the existence of the rays of the sun has as their basis the sun.
What was that verse then?
14:27. Brahmanohi pratishtaham. In the beginning part of chapter 14, he speaks of Mahad Brahman. Mahad Brahman refers to the total material ingredients. But there are three ways in which the word Brahman, standard ways in which the word Brahman is used. One is Mahad Brahman, it refers to the material ingredients. Another is the living entity, which is also Brahman. That's us, we're also Brahman. Then there's Para Brahman. Para Brahman is the, at the conclusion of chapter 14, is the pratishtha, or basis of existential basis, or support. Of both matter and spirit, Mahad Brahman and the living entities, us. And Krishna is declaring in the 14th chapter, I am the pratishtha of that. Pratishtha is a nice word. It's like but different. This little amplifier box is resting on top of the speaker, and the speaker is, you know, one thing is resting upon another thing. It's not that, you know, it's not that physical, describing a physical relationship, it's describing an existential relationship. That something exists based upon some prior existence or substantial existence. So Krishna is the substantive basis, existential basis of Brahman. But the classic example is rays of sun and the sun. Because in the spiritual world, far, far beyond the covering, take away all the covering, go beyond the whole cloud of material existence, and outside of that there's the spiritual sky where Brahman, the effulgence of the spiritual sky, is there. And within the spiritual sky, there's spiritual planets, and within the spiritual planets, there's presiding personalities, Narayan, forms of the Lord, and he has spiritual form. There's another very important, say it three times, very, very, very important verse from the Bhagavatam. 1329, I think it is, where Krishna says, especially if you have a little exposure to impersonalism, the verse starts, Vedanta tat tatva vidas tatvam yajnanam advayam. Advaya? Advaya means non-dual. Advaita. You've heard that word before? Advaita. Dvaita means non-dual. So in this realm is dual. The word water and the substance water are different. There's distinctions between the object and the object name. The world of duality, there's as hot, as cold, as pleasure, as pain, as happiness, as sad, as honor, as dishonor, as up and down. This is the realm of duality. The spiritual realm is the realm of absolutes. Advaita. So, in that absolute realm, the verse says, there are these different features. Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, all of the same non-dual substance. So, you know, for the impersonalist, they would say, no. Because as soon as you have diversity or plurality, then you're in this realm of duality. It's got to just be homogenized. It's got to be all one. To have non-dual, it has to be all one. Because as soon as you have more than one, it's dual. The answer to that argument is, my dear sir, your arguments are fallacious. Based upon the statements of Scripture, there is this non-dual realm. And the non-dual realm has non-dual stages of realization of that non-dual realm. And one stage of realization is the Brahman stage. Another is the Paramatma stage, the Lord of the Heart, is non-dual. That's what this Bhagavatam verse that we just read says. And the Bhagavan feature is also non-dual. Krishna has a spiritual form. And that spiritual form isn't of material ingredients. It's spiritual form. Because, so here's the problem. Prabhupada in one sentence says it. The problem is, if you hold the binary processor, that's the mind, to something that's absolute, you can't, the light doesn't come through. You can't estimate something that is absolute with the instrument of the binary processor, with the mind. Because either or, it's either one or many, it can't be one and many. Looking at Scripture through the lens of the mind, sufficient light doesn't come through because you can't approach the conclusion of the absolute truth with mental speculation. And gee, that's probably because, you know, our whole education process is working with this binary processor, just fine-tuning it. And we look at all the work that we've done. We've got this and that and that and that and that. We've learned so many things, got so many gadgets, and you mean to tell me we can't go to the Scriptures and use that same program? We gotta, like, get another program? That's the problem. Scholarship is insufficient. Even Munis, the best of the speculators, and in Vedic culture, they had big time speculators. That capacity of the expand the mind and encompass the absolute truth, you can't, because it's beyond the mind. It doesn't fit. You can't encompass the absolute truth with the mind, however good the mind is, or however sharp the intellect is. It can't penetrate because it's of another dimension. So, in that absolute realm, there are diversities. Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. Vedanta tattaka vidas tattam yajnanam adhayam brahmetu paramatmetu bhagavanetu shabhyate. Very important verse. 1339. Bhagavatam. Key verse. So what we're hearing, summarized, the Lord Brahma and the invitation of us accepts there is both this impersonal and personal form simultaneously coexisting. And it's not a problem that simultaneously things are coexisting. Because God, the Supreme Absolute Truth, is full. And there's no limit to what He can do and what He is. So the statement is, He has these different features. And it's not a problem. The impersonalist says, no. It's a problem. Avyaktamurti. And spiritual form, no. And that's an impersonal. So, in the purport, Prabhupada is explaining, because of the methodology they're using, it limits their capacity to understand. And if they want to, for one who wants to understand, another methodology needs to be taken up. The methodology of descending knowledge that becomes disclosed, and it becomes disclosed in the heart of one who is carrying devotion, who simply hears, not blindly accepts, but simply hears, and through the process of hearing, gradually the coverings become removed, and then it becomes illumined within the heart. This is this revelation or realization, proportionate to one's devotion or devotional service. It's nice, isn't it?
I was just wondering, there are so many of these verses which very clearly explain the personal feature of the Lord.
Yeah.
And it is
very clear.
For example, if Shankaracharya tries to, he would have definitely commented on Esau Commission. How would he even go past the invocation verse?
Well, I haven't read his commentary, but you know the principle that's used, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu discusses in his language or his interaction with Prakashananda of the Saraswati. He has taken indirect meanings, and with scholarship one can do that. And there's integrity with that, the logic that applies. And so it sounds really, wow, that's really logical and that's impressive. But it's indirect meanings. That's how it's done. I attended a class with a group of Bengalis. And I wasn't ready for it, but then I could understand immediately that, you know, what they were expecting was the Kananda kind of stuff, where, you know, this means that, and that means this. That's what they wanted. And I had to say, you know, I'm sorry, but direct meaning. And that's the rule of Sanskrit. And, you know, it's a no-no if you break the rule. And that's what he does. He breaks the rule. He goes to indirect meanings. The logic behind the reference to indirect meaning is this. It's just on the presupposition that all there is Brahman. So when you have something that indicates there's something other than Brahman, you have to go to an indirect meaning, because all there is Brahman. So this means that, and that means this, because all there is Brahman.
But when all there is Brahman, then how can they explain Brahmanohi Pratishtha?
I don't know what he does. But it's something. It's like in two places where I know, man mana bhavalad bhakto, the commentary says, it's not that you think of Krishna. Because you can't think of Krishna, because that's not transcendental. You think of the unborn, unmanifest within Krishna. You're taking in direct meaning. Surrender unto me. Don't surrender unto Krishna. you surrender to the unborn, unmanifest within Krishna. And so there's consistency. That's what vada means. It's like a very tight system. Based upon a certain doctrine or vada. The vada says all there is Brahman. And then you look at everything with that lens. And if a direct meaning doesn't fit that lens, you go to an indirect meaning. This means that.
You said that they have an existing hypothesis, not hypothesis, but
perception
that everything is Brahman, and based off that, they translate all the, they write commentaries on the Vedic literature.
Yeah.
Now, in order to have that preconception, you need to have, it cannot just come out of nowhere. Yeah, I mean, there has to be some previous authority who passed down that message to you, right? How did that conception come about? Meaning,
Shankaracharya, being an incarnation of Lord Shiva, was very powerful. And, he just, like this discussion earlier, yesterday, about, it seems to me the revelation is the highest platform. So this is the revealed truth. Shankara Lumacha. And that's how and it being so powerful, it was accepted by a lot of people, and to this day is accepted by a lot of people. So you're trained by good fortune. You have some training to understand, hey, wait a minute. But there are a lot of people that don't go, hey, wait a minute. It goes on. I mean, without naming names, it goes on today. Somebody says, I'm Swami Narayan. Somebody says, I'm God. I can produce gold in my hand. And people don't say, well, excuse me for just a moment here. There's a gentleman going around India today, he's saying he's called the Avatar. At least one, probably more than one. At least one very famous one. And because you're trained, you say, hey, wait a minute. But there are a lot of people not trained, and they don't do that. They just, wow. That's how it happens. And Shankaracharya is very powerful. Very powerful. He drove all the Buddhists out of India. Powerful. Cool. Powerful. And he lived such a short life. Powerful. Imagine.
Lord Shiva, so maybe he could do that.
Yeah. No, yeah, no, maybe. He had a mandate. He had a job to do. And he did it. Did he?
Maharaj, I've always had a problem with this Brahma, 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 Brahma. How it's related to the Satchitananda Nakshatra.
They correspond. There's a one-to-one correlation between Sat, Chit, and Ananda, and Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Sat feature is the existential feature, which is Brahman. Paramatma gives knowledge. So it's also Sat, but Chit. And the Ananda is manifest by Bhagavan, which has both Sat and Chit. and Ananda. Then you go backwards, and there's some Brahmananda. There's some happiness in Brahman. That happiness, this is a nectar devotion, that happiness is the cessation of material suffering. It's like banging your head against the wall and then you stop. Brahmananda. The cessation of material suffering is the happiness that's realized in Brahman. But the positive bliss of one's relationship with and loving exchange with the personal feature of the Supreme is not yet experienced. One's in that realm, but it's not yet realized. And then the chit or cognizant feature, knowledge feature, is the experience of the yogi or the mystic who sees the form of the Lord, and that's also a greater bliss than the cessation of material existence. Yet that bliss is less than the consummate bliss of a loving relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it's gradations. The fullness of Satchit Ananda is realized in the Bhagavan feature.
So the soul experiences these
when it realizes? Yes, exactly. There's stages of realization of the Absolute Truth. And those progressive stages have names. Realization of Brahman. Realization of Paramatma. Realization of Bhagavan. So this, and with that, one is realizing oneself in stages. Complete, more complete, most complete. Progressively. Is that right?
In the Bhagavad Gita 9th chapter, you were mentioning that in my Krishna says in manifest form the whole material world is pervaded. Is that Mahatattva?
No. Here, thanks for the question. It's in the purport of text 39. I'll just read what Prabhupada says and we can. The impersonal conception of the Absolute Truth, capital A, capital T. The impersonal conception of the Absolute Truth is also a form of the Lord called Avyaktamurti. Murti means form. But because his impersonal feature is inexplicable to our material senses, he is the Avyaktamurti form. And in that inexplicable form of the Lord, the whole cosmic creation is resting. That's the Avyaktamurti. Now here's what he says about Mahatattva. So, this Mahavishnu is the first incarnation in the creation, and from him all universes are generated, and all material manifestations are produced one after another. The causal ocean is like synonyms. The causal ocean is created by the Lord as the Mahatattva, comma, as a cloud in the spiritual sky, and is only a part of his different manifestations. So they're not. It's not a one-to-one correlation. The Avyaktamurti and the Mahatattva. There's some overlap, but it's not the same. Mahatattva is the cloud of material energy, or also the causal ocean, within which the Supreme Lord lies and rests. And the Avyaktamurti is that in which that form of the Lord, in which the whole universe rests. So, it's Venn diagram. There's some overlap, but it's not identical. Points of similarity, but points of difference also. Anything else? Yeah?
Maharaj, I always have this question and I wanted to know how we can understand this properly. Why does there need to be any purpose to anything? In the sense that we say what is the purpose of human form of life? So there is an inherent implication that there has to be purpose behind the.
Well, it's not that there has to be, but there is. Just like, you know, why does Krishna have to be? Same. He is. So it's not a cause of Krishna, that's the cause, and then Krishna is the effect. Living entities exist as part of Krishna, and there's a purpose. It's not, there's something, once upon a time there were no living entities, and then there was a cause, whatever that cause is, and then that cause brought about the living entities, and then they existed to fulfill a cause or purpose. They're eternal. They're co-eternal with Krishna, or we. And that there's a purpose. There's a purpose of the soul, the purpose of the human form of life. You're okay? Yeah.
You said last night that understanding the absolute truth, like even great sages cannot understand it completely. So, how much can a person understand even if he endeavors?
That exactly the point. We can understand proportionate to our devotion. I mean, the discussion we're having over here last night was the absolute is unlimited, and we're limited. So, because of our limitedness, we can understand the Supreme perfectly to a limited degree because of our limitedness. So that's the answer to the question. And that the fullness of our limitedness is achieved through devotion. But the recommendation or the injunction again and again is to enter into the understanding of Krishna, try to understand Krishna. But we can't understand the fullness of Krishna. But nonetheless, we're to try to understand. Because we have, just like someone, you know, that you have as a friend. Because they're your friend. I want to understand my friend because they're my friend. They have feelings. They have some concerns and some needs, and I like to understand them. I can't understand them fully. But because, out of love, or the friendship. I want to understand. Like that, we have an eternal relationship with Krishna. I want to understand. So that it will facilitate the relationship. And so it's not an item of curiosity like something academic. It's an item of our eternal existence and our loving relationship with Him. I would like to know how to please Him. I'd like to enter into a fuller, loving relationship that will be enhanced the more I can understand. And then conversely, the more I have a loving relationship, the more I will be able to understand. So I want to understand so it will enhance the loving relationship. Not another piece of information that I put in my information basket and walk down the street saying, look at all the stuff in my basket. I've got this, you know, some understanding about Krishna in my basket. Check it out.
But then how can it be called absolute truth when you just know a part of it?
It's just, the absolute truth means that from which everything comes. That's why we call it the Absolute Truth. That's Krishna. He is the source of everything. We don't have the capacity to think of everything or the source of everything completely. But to some degree we can have some understanding. And to the degree that we have some understanding, it excites our desire to serve. It enhances the relationship. Prabhupada says it this way: all religions teach that God is great. How great He is, that they do not know. But the more we understand how great God is, the more one is inspired to serve Him. I want to be inspired to serve Him. More and more and more. Let me hear more of His glory, from His greatness. And more inspired, more inspired, more inspired. And so, supposing I don't have an understanding of His greatness, and I really have some issues with, you know, you get down to real life, and you know, here comes a curveball. You know, just was standing there, and all of a sudden, boom! What happened? Now I can have an issue with God because I don't, you know, what happened? I don't have an idea. People suffer and then they have issues with God. Or they see suffering and they have issues with God. So it helps to have an understanding of how things happen. What's the relationship between God and His energies? Not just in an abstract, peaceful setting, but in real life. And when it's fixed in one's relationship with God, then one can see those situations as God sees those situations, not as someone that has, you know, has their agenda. Like, I want to be the controller and the enjoyer in this temporary place that I really don't have the title to. I've stolen goods. And I got my rules of how things are supposed to be. Hey, that's my problem. That's Krishna's problem. He doesn't line up with my rules. I got an issue with him. Something's wrong. It's not over there. It's over here. So how does it work? So then, okay, let me let go of I got my rules and I got stolen property. Now, how does it really happen? And Scripture provides us in that space of goodness and transcendence, even, to get a glimmer of how it's happening. And the more that we can absorb ourselves in harmony with that which is coming to us from God and being purified souls, then we're in harmony with God. We have a picture of how things are. We can carry on even in extreme dualities. Not only the tough ones, even, you know, lots of praise. It's hard to stay fixed in spiritual consciousness when there's lots of praise. Yeah. I'm great. I did it. I'm smart. I'm the president. You just go around bashing people because you're the president. And, you know, in smaller ways, people do stuff like that all the time. So, in both features of duality, how to stay fixed in transcendence. We're getting that opportunity through Scripture. That's what self-realization is. Illusion is dismissed and reality is the focus. One goes through life following a very clear picture of reality as one executes duties of life in a proper manner, in a godly manner, and stays fixed in transcendence, or is guided to that position of transcendence by this way of life. Bhagavad Dharma, way of life. So we're doing some conceptual adjustments this morning, but the real test is what's in our heart. And the conceptions are to help guide us, and then the purity of heart is really what it comes down to. We need the guidance also, because otherwise someone can feel very inspired. I've got this realization. Look out, here I come. I'm divinely inspired. Anything that gets in my way gets moved out of the way, because I've got the divine inspiration of God. Okay. That could be dangerous if it's not properly guided. And the guidance is necessary and the purity is necessary. Both. Knowledge without a pure heart is dry speculation, and that which cleanses the heart increases one's sentiments and can become fanaticism if it's not properly guided. So both are needed side by side. But it's not the Bhagavatam is only, it's some intellectual thing. It's purifying. Like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, one who studies the sacred conversation is worshipping with his intelligence. So if we could have spiritualized pure intelligence guiding our life, that's a good thing.
Today, it is said that Swami Vivekananda achieved some form of samadhi. Do they achieve any form of realization, any form of samadhi?
I don't know. I don't know about Vivekananda's life enough to comment about Vivekananda's realization and his destination. But let's take it away from Swami Vivekananda and just say, what's the destination of a realized impersonalist? There's a difference between, subtle but an important difference between one who has Brahman realization, or a Brahma body, and a Maya body. A Maya body, or this brand of impersonalism, because there's this general heading and then there's subdivisions. And a Maya body is one who denies the existence of a form of God. The Brahma body has realization of Brahman. They don't have realization of Bhagavan, but they have realization of Brahman. My body doesn't have realization of Brahman. It's intellectual word juggling. Intellectualize or philosophize God out of existence. So there are different destinations. There's one that philosophizing God out of existence is offensive. And Brahman realization is Brahman realization, that their destination is Brahman. The destination of a Maya body is down.
What does it mean, destination of Brahman? So what actually happens?
When the soul merges, it's Sayujya Mukti. The soul merges, their concentration is upon Brahman, and that's where the soul goes, to Brahman. The Brahman feature of the Absolute, emerge into the existence of Brahman.
And then do they come back?
Yes.
Okay.
Aruya Krishna Param Param Tadapatan Yadho Nadita Yushmad Angraya. Because the verse says, because their intelligence, Abhishuddha Buddhaya, their intelligence is not yet fully purified. Or another way of saying the same thing is, the soul has a constitutional loving relationship with the Supreme. If that constitutional loving relationship with the Supreme is not restored, you can't stay. You go high, high, high. unless you take shelter, again you have to come down. And this is the place where that loving relationship with the Supreme is, the facility for reviving it is provided. That's the purpose of the human form of life. If that purpose of the human form of life isn't served, isn't fulfilled, I may go different places, but in course of time, that ultimate place has to be reached. That's the goal or the purpose. Restoring that. So, having not restored that loving relationship, I may have understood the temporary nature of matter, and I may have understood the eternal nature of Brahman. But having not understood the loving exchange that exists between the soul and Bhagavan, I have to go back to school. And this is school. This is a place for the soul to learn.
I think I've heard somewhere that some souls achieve liberation. They go to Vaikuntha, but they become, you know, they become trees, or they become.
But that may be their constitutional service to the Supreme Lord.
Oh.
They may become whatever they become, whatever that is. That's their constitutional position. Whatever it is.
So that's not incomplete.
So whatever, if there's the state of neutrality, there's Shanta Rasa, Dasya Rasa, Sakta Rasa, Vatsanya Rasa, Madhuri Rasa. One of those rasas has been their constitutional rasa, whatever that is.
So it's not that all human beings, they have to be a kind of, a personal form in Vaikuntha.
That's personal. They're serving the Supreme Lord.
Yeah, but I mean, not
to hit the delete button.
Yeah.
And don't think in terms of bodily conception.
Yeah.
It's not just in a human form, those in the human form. Spirit souls, whatever the present embodied state is, all spirit souls have constitutionally an eternal relationship with God. And when they again manifest that eternal, constitutional relationship with God, they're completely fulfilled. They're not pulling on the chin saying, gee, I wish I could. There's no envy, there's no jealousy, there's no sense of incompleteness. It's complete, whatever it is. They're fully satisfied. The cowherd boys are thinking, gee, I didn't make the team. They're fully satisfied.
But how can a tree or
please don't sit in your tiny brain and try to think of the spiritual happiness of a living entity in relation with Narayana. That's their constitutional service to him. They're fully happy. You could say the same thing. How can a cowherd boy, knowing, you know, how much fun the gopis are having, be satisfied? I got the B team instead of the A team. They're fully satisfied. And there's so many parrots. How come that parrot has to be Radharani's parrot? I want to be Radharani's parrot. There's no ending in the spiritual world. Okay, I'm going to end. Thank you very much for the call.
Upamara ki jai.